Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to our second part of the Napoleon Life and Times. And I'm joined here once again with Zach White. And this time we are going to focus heavily on the Napoleonic Wars. But before we go into the wars itself, I want to begin where we left off the last time, which is the crown coronation of the Emperor Napoleon. And I want to begin a little bit, because I want to talk about Josephine as well, because there was quite a dilemma and discussion. Should she be at the coronation? Should she not be? So it seemed to me that a lot of people resented that she should not be, you know, at the coronation, but she did end up being there. So let's talk a little bit about the mess, or not mess, but the leading up to the coronation and the coronation itself.
Sure, the Josephine situation is always going to be complex, not least because she's not popular with a lot of Bonaparte's family. In part, that's perhaps because of the affairs. Obviously, Bonaparte's own family quietly ignoring his own affairs and actually encouraging him to have his own affairs. There's also a lot of concern about whether or not she can actually have kids. And as we start to transition towards empire, that kid question becomes ever more significant because now it's about hereditary succession rather than just, well, look, there isn't a little Napoleon running around the place. There's a bit of an issue as well in terms of the fact that their marriage was a civil ceremony and not a church ceremony. And as a result of that, there are a lot of questions about whether or not whether the marriage is valid in front of God. And she sort of plays a bit of a blinder by managing to get the Pope to turn around and say, look, I can't crown the two of you if you haven't been married before God. And so she effectively secures this stay of execution when it comes to her marriage, because, you know, there's always this kind of movement and these machinations against her. She secures this sort of stay of execution of the demise of their marriage by getting herself married in a church ceremony the night before the coronation, so that then they can both be crowned the following day. The coronation is very much Napoleon. It's Napoleon doing it his way. And this is what comes through very clearly in the snippets that we've seen leaked and released in advance. You know, this idea of Napoleon crowning himself, he's sending a very emphatic message. Mm. There are sources to suggest that some of that was agreed beforehand, but at the same time, this idea that Napoleon would crown himself rather than the Pope crowning him, but at the same time, he is sending a message about who is more important in that relationship. And it's part of this ongoing kind of fight that he has with the Vatican. But he is effectively saying, I am emperor of the French. That is a really important distinction. He's not emperor of France. He's the emperor of the French. He obviously legitimizes this with his plebiscite. We talked, I think, last time about Napoleonic democracy and its inverted commas flaws. It is there, but it is sometimes used as a veneer to give legitimacy to the government. And so when he's doing this, he's kind of saying, look, things are done differently. I am crowning myself. I'm not reliant on the Pope. I'm not reliant on God. I have fought my way to this point, and I am claiming this crown on behalf of the French people. And that's a very powerful and important message. That is a marked shift from other authoritarian regimes in Europe during this period.
Hello, I want to introduce two people, and one is more important than the other, of course, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. But for those who may not know, there was two sly little bastards that joined the Napoleonic court, and one of them is Fouché, who would somehow survived both the Napoleonic and the Bourbon government, and the other one is another sly little bastard with the betray. But as one of his biographers pointed out, one of his many biographers pointed out, that he had his reasons to betray Napoleon eventually. He tried to make him listen to him, and of course that is Talleyrand who eventually would betray. I mean, we'll come back to Talleyrand, of course, after Austerlitz, but let's talk a little bit about these two sly little bastards, as I call them.
Sure. Do we have a swear filter on this show?
No,
No.
no,
Okay.
don't give
So
me.
people will like this. Napoleon referred to Talleyrand as a shit in a silk stocking. So there you go. That's clearly they didn't get along terribly well on occasion. But Napoleon knows he needs him. There's a really good analogy that I sometimes use about how it's better to have somebody inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. Now, sometimes I suspect Napoleon felt that Talleyrand was inside the tent pissing in, which is obviously the worst of all worlds. But I think part of the thing with Talleyrand, he has a long history. He survives the revolution by being very delicate in how he plays his steps. I think that Talleyrand is interested in what he considers to be two things. Firstly, I think he's probably more focused on what he regards as France's interests rather than Napoleon's, which obviously is problematic for Napoleon. But also, I think Talleyrand is very interested in Talleyrand's interests. And so he is somebody who comes in and out of office. So he does resign on occasion when he has concerns, particularly about Napoleon's ambition, about whether or not what he's planning is feasible, whether it's going to lead to stability. But he's always there. He's always floating in the background, offering advice even after he's resigned. He's one of these whisperers behind the thrones, kind of a bit of a spider. He's sort of there with all the threads, trying to control things just enough to keep France the way he thinks France should be. And this is not that unusual. You've also got people like Metternich during this period, the Austrian politician who is also playing devious little games on occasion when it suits him. And then we mentioned Fouché. So Fouché is widely regarded as a very sinister character in France during this period. He's in charge of the state police. And it's important to remember, Napoleonic France is a dictatorship. And that isn't unusual during this period because absolutist monarchies are themselves dictatorships. And that was very much the norm. As we said already, democracy is kind of the veneer that gives everything legitimacy. But together, Fouché and Napoleon basically write the playbook on state control, which is then used after the war by other nations to implement their own secret police and state controls because it is so effective. So Fouché has spies seemingly everywhere.
And
He
he
gets
does,
all.
as I said, he does survive both Napoleonic regime and as well the Bourbon, so he must do something right.
Absolutely, because he makes himself so vital. A nice analogy for people who've seen Game of Thrones would be Varys. That master of whisperers, you know, with his little birds everywhere. Very similar principle in that, you know, Fouché is able to produce daily reports to put on Napoleon's desk about what has been said in certain locations in Paris. He's also getting feeders from w the wider, wider France. So he is the person who is helping Napoleon to keep control of France. For the reasons of stability for Bonaparte's regime.
And before we go into the Napoleonic Wars, of course, I want to talk about Napoleon's work ethic, because they were rather unusual, you might say, and especially for his unfortunate secretary who would be awakened middle of the night. He slept very little, Napoleon, and the few times he took a break, it was just a few hours bath, and he hardly slept at all. What I want to emphasize is that he did, at least in the beginning, he began doing quite well as a dictator, and he did emperor. He controlled the grain and the economics, and he, of course, the army as well. He did, and of course, it's because of Napoleon that we have this two-street system as well that he organized. That's one of the first times, I believe, according to a Swedish historian, that we have this two-street system that 5 on one side and 6 on the other, if you know what I mean, street numbers. So, I mean, he began at least very good in governing the French states.
Yeah, absolutely. Napoleon, I mean, we focus a lot on his political career, perhaps inevitably, because that's what sort of seems to capture a lot of people's imagination and excites them that little bit more. But in the early stages, Napoleon is really beneficial to France. You've got to think about the anarchy of the revolution. You have a series of attempts to create constitutions that fall through. You've got increasingly radical factions for much of it trying to gain control. Napoleon brings stability, and that's important. The challenge, of course, becomes when post, I would say, 1805, he then starts to think outwards. But before that point, I would actually say that Napoleon is the man that France needs at that moment in time. His Napoleonic Code lasts to this day in a number of instances. It is the foundation for the French legal system. It's then exported around the world. It is reasonably progressive for the time. It was also sorely needed because France had different laws in different sections of the country. So in some places, you could exempt yourself from tax completely, and in others, you had to pay huge amounts of tax. It was a huge mess. And Napoleon resolves that with his code. The code isn't entirely positive. It reinstitutes slavery, which had been abolished during the revolution. It also enshrines in the state a huge misogyny, which people will say, well, that was typical of the time to a degree, but it was again a step backwards from the rights that women had gained during the revolution. So we have this complexity with Napoleon's life where, on the one hand, his reforms were definitely needed, but at the same time, about half the population of France probably ended up worse off from his rule in legal rights than benefited, because the system of patriarchy that gets built into French law basically makes it incredibly hard for women to run their own lives. They require their husband's permission for many things.
I
It's
think Ken
difficult.
would approve of the patriarchates.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
I think Ken would approve of the
Quite possibly, quite possibly. There's a nice
patriarchates.
little Barbie reference in there for people. But yeah, for his work ethic, he was incredibly, incredibly motivated. He also had, as you say, an ability to work through the night, could wear out multiple secretaries with his letter writing, could pivot from writing a letter to a bereaved mother in one moment through to a letter to the Austrian Emperor, and then on to dictating a new law, and then turning again to write on military matters about how depots needed to be resupplied. An incredible a capacity there that is phenomenal. There is a question mark over whether the fact that he went on so little sleep might have contributed to his cognitive decline, because we know that you need sleep in order to work. We can only speculate on that. But certainly in the early years of his life, he was absolutely phenomenal, in terms of that work ethic and what he produced.
So let's begin with the beginning of the Napoleonic War and what led up to, because I believe, and I might be wrong here, but again, a Swedish historian who wrote an excellent biography on Napoleon as well, he claims that in really the most people declared Napoleon never really declared war on anyone. There was other nations. I don't know how right he is, but now that other nations declared war on him, I don't know that it was more a defensive war in a sense, sort of. But how
This
right
is
is
a
he on this?
yeah, this is a particular school of thought. Napoleon is the man of peace. And you can make a certain argument that what happens quite often is that other nations become disgruntled and then declare war on Napoleon. Now, it doesn't work universally. It certainly does work in relation to Waterloo, but Waterloo will get to it's a different kind of set of circumstances. When it comes to other wars, the invasion of Russia is a preemptive strike because he knows war's coming, but he does make the first move. The one that you can't explain away is what he does to Portugal and Spain, starting off the Peninsular War. So in 1807, he decides that he's going to implement the continental system, going to shut all of the ports in Europe to British trade and sort of starve Britain into submission. Nice idea. But he is trying to dictate the economic policy of an entire continent. And that therefore means that independent nations need to toe the line. So when Portugal, a long-standing ally of Britain, turns around and goes, thanks, but we're good. You know, we decide our own economic policy in our own country that's not controlled by you. So bye. They get threatened with invasion. Quite simply, you're going to do it my way, or I'm going to occupy you and make you do it anyway. There's a lot of sort of to-ing and fro-ing. Eventually, the Portuguese agree, and then he invades anyway. And then he follows up, having moved a lot of troops into Spain under that kind of pretext of, I've got an invasion of Portugal coming. He then stabs his ally Spain in the back, takes control of the, literally captures, makes prisoner the King of Spain and his heir, invites them to Fontainebleau on a pretext that he's going to try and sort out disagreements between the two of them, and then basically says, none of you are fit for running the country. I'm taking control. And that kicks off the what the Spanish call the Guerra de la Independencia, the War of Independence, where they are trying to fight against a French occupation under, Napoleon's brother, Joseph. So
yeah, let's talk about Joseph's rule for a second, because he was not his brother, and he was, I'm not sure he even wanted to rule Spain, because though he wanted power, he was not competent at all for ruling Spain.
The big problem for French control of Spain, is that you need a strong figure in overall command, directing strategy when the country rises up, and you don't have that. And as a result, what you have is a series of marshals jockeying for position, sometimes refusing to cooperate or refusing to take orders from somebody who's been appointed to a higher rank than themselves, because they feel aggrieved. And nobody's listening to Joseph, because Joseph is not the strong figure. Joseph was the wrong appointment, quite frankly. I can understand why he'd had success elsewhere, but this is kind of an indication of some of the cronyism that sometimes underpins Napoleon's rule, that he will take people that he believes he can trust and starts to try and create his own European dynasty by plopping his various siblings and their spouses onto other European thrones and creating satellite states.
Weren't you also the one who was supposed to study to become a Catholic priest at some point, or was that another brother?
No, absolutely. We've got a number of brothers in that family. You've got Lucien as well. Lucien, very key in helping Napoleon, as we discussed last time during the Brumaire coup.
And I want to talk about his family again as well, because he does marry off his sisters as well. And I do believe one of them married off a boor and a transvestite as well at the time, which, you know, it was not a match in heaven. I'm not sure if I'm getting this right, but I do. I mean, one of them at least marry someone she does not fancy very well. I'm not remember, sure, don't remember where I read it. It was someone else I might think of, but I do believe
it, I'm not familiar with that particular one. I mean, Caroline ends up with Murat, which is a match made in hell. They deserve each other, quite frankly. it's a tumultuous relationship. In fact, Murat is part of the reason why the situation in Spain explodes so badly during the start of the Peninsular War, because there's a revolt in the Spanish capital, Madrid, and a couple of French soldiers are killed, because what's happening is that these people are rioting over the fact that their royal family has been snapped up and made prisoner in France. You can kind of understand why they might have problems with that, Spain being a particularly proud nation as well. And yet, Murat's response when some French soldiers are killed is to have every drop of blood paid for in blood. And so he clears the streets, rounds up anybody who's found with a weapon in their hands, and executes them. And this, it just fans the flames, because the news of this gets out. It's treated like a cold-blooded massacre, which in some respects, you know, these people are being shot in cold blood. And effectively, by being too authoritarian, it creates a propaganda coup for the cause of Spanish independence that then just ignites across the country. And of course, Britain looks at this and goes, this is a perfect opportunity to exploit, because Britain's still at war with Napoleon during this point. So yes, it is the case, if we double back to what we'd originally raised, that you can make the argument that at times Napoleon didn't necessarily want war, particularly in 1815 when he comes back. Why doesn't he want war? There's a very simple answer for that. he's not ready for it.
Mm.
Which then begs the question, if Napoleon keeps winning these wars, which he obviously does, right? We all know about Napoleon's military successes, whether it's Austerlitz, whether it's Jena and Auerstadt, whether it's Friedland, whether it's Wagram, he has this succession of victories. So why is there this inclination for these states to turn around and go, hey, let's go to war with Napoleon? You know, we haven't been hounded by him for, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years. That will be fun, won't it? Well, the reason is because of the peace settlements. Because Napoleon is so good at waging war, it means that he can demand everything that he wants. He can dictate the peace. And because of that ability to dictate the peace, you have the power to ask for too much. If you're in a position of negotiation, you have to compromise. And with that compromise comes a better degree of understanding. With Napoleon extracting too much, he basically wins the war but loses the peace, because the terms are so harsh that it breeds resentment. And then that fans the flames of discontent to the point where these nations feel so humiliated that they are inclined to go back to war to try and level the balance back and create a stability, a balance of power in Europe that isn't so heavily swayed in France's favour.
And Britain, of course, did not want one power to rule the entirety of Europe, because, which is ironic considering they are basically the world at the time. But Europe, God forbid that one country would rule pretty much the entire continent. But we have to talk about some of the famous battles, of course, and it's what this episode is mainly about. And that is, of course, I want to begin at the Battle of Trafalgar.
Ah, yes, Trafalgar. Everybody goes, this is the battle that saved England. No, very sorry. Actually, by the point, Trafalgar should never have been fought. We'll get to that in a second. But by the time Trafalgar is being fought, actually, Napoleon's already packed up his army that was poised on the Channel coast of France, waiting for the opportunity to cross the Channel and invade. And he's marched it out for what will become the Austerlitz campaign, which no doubt we'll talk about in due course. Trafalgar should never have been fought for a very simple reason, and that is that there was meant to be a change of commander. So a new commander is being sent down to replace Villeneuve, who's gone on this very long campaign trying to outwit Nelson, sails the the French fleet all the way from the Med over to the West Indies and back again, gets chased there and back by Nelson, but he's forced to divert towards Cadiz. And he's in port. He then hears through the grapevine that Napoleon's lost his rag about the fact that Villeneuve hasn't managed to get the French Med fleet up to the English Channel, where they can take on the English Channel fleet, completely separate fleet to the one that Nelson commands. And as a result of that, he's sending a new commander down. So Villeneuve's bright idea is to sail away from this problem. So he gets the fleet, he sails out, he gets cornered by Nelson, and he loses the Battle of Trafalgar. Obviously, Nelson dies in the process. It's a hugely, you could do a whole podcast, frankly, on Trafalgar itself, but it is a hugely famous naval loss for France. It breeds some resentment within Spain, because it's a Franco-Spanish fleet, so the Spanish are dragged into this as well. But even if Villeneuve had won at Trafalgar, it wouldn't have changed the fact that the British still have the Channel fleet, which is the biggest. It's designed for home defence, and until Napoleon defeats the Channel fleet, he can't buy the time to get his troops across the Channel for an invasion of Great Britain anyway.
I gotta ask you about another movie, of course, and I'm sure you know which one I'm talking about right now. That is, of course, Master and Commander. How accurately did it portray naval warfare at the time of Napoleon?
I love Master and Commander because it spends a lot of time trying to get the little things right. And by doing that, it actually has a reasonably authentic feel, probably as authentic as you can get in a film, about what life
more than
is
Ridley
like
Scott.
On board. Yes, far, far more than Ridley Scott. Because Ridley Scott's attitude, seemingly, is I'm going to make this the way I want to make it, which you can understand from a film creation perspective. But there is a happy medium, and you can focus on getting the little bits right,
yeah,
in order to create that more authentic experience. Now, Master and Commander has the advantage of not telling a real story. It's actually a mishmash of a number of the books on the Aubrey and Maturin series. So if you were a purist and wanted to see, you know, book one in its entirety, then you would probably look at Master and Commander and not be too happy. But if you speak to anybody with a love of the Napoleonic era and of Master and Commander, by and large, they turn around and say that Master and Commander is one of the best Napoleonic films ever produced. And it just got very unlucky, I feel, in that it came out the same year as Pirates of the Caribbean 1. And so people had kind of had their sort of piratey, boaty fix for that year. And so it flopped at the box office.
But it still remains a passage among history buffs, of course.
It really does. They focus on getting the little things right. They even sent, who's the guy who plays Maturin? Paul Bettany, to the leading expert on Napoleonic surgery. And that guy then taught him how they would have handled the instruments for the surgery scenes. So that he is kind of manipulating those various tools in the way that they would have done during the period. And it's those little things that therefore mean that somebody like me can look at this and firstly love the story, love the drama, love the action, but also appreciate that attention to detail.
And of course, we have to move on because we don't have too much time, unfortunately. So let's just move on to one of the more famous. And we have to talk about Alexander and Napoleon, or Nakby, as I call him, about the famous bridge meeting, the boat meeting, sorry. But let's talk about the Battle of Austerlitz. And let's get it right out right away. There was no ice nonsense, as we've seen in the clip that has been shared. There was, that's all fiction. Again, it's not accurate.
Yeah, it's fish ponds. It's not this great sort of vast lake that, you know, a part of the issue is that the trailer gives the indication that the entire strategy at Austerlitz hangs on the lakes. Now, we've seen what I'm told is a shorter version of the full battle in the 2 minute clip that's been released. And I hope that that's the case. Because I think that probably is the case because some of the editing doesn't quite hang together in this 2 minute version that we've seen. But the premise of Austerlitz is to feign weakness, to throw a massive dummy, sucker his opponent into attacking him, and then shatter the entire army. So Napoleon begins by occupying the Pratzen Heights before the battle even starts. Then he comes off the Pratzen Heights and adopts another position and enables his enemy to take this dominant point overlooking his army. And you go, well, why the hell would he do that? He then continues to feign weakness by having a very weak right flank. That's where he wants the Austrians and Russians to attack him, weakening their position that they've occupied on the Pratzen Heights so that he can then retake it himself. This entire plan is then reinforced by the fact that he's sending envoys, raising the prospect of peace negotiations, creating this idea that he doesn't want to fight a battle. Then the next day, it dawns. It's very, very foggy. But as the fog clears, it's very apparent that the Austrians are coming down off the center, off the Pratzen Heights, to go and attack this deliberately weakened right flank. But the point about Napoleon is that he has reinforcements on the way. So Third Corps arrives just in the nick of time.
And again, to an analogy, that kind of reminds me of the Game of Thrones. That kind of reminds me of the Battle of Winterfell a little bit when they come in with the battle in the last minute. So it kind of reminds me of that scene a little bit, though.
I guess, kind of, in the sense. But then John doesn't know that the reinforcements are coming. That's Sansa's.
That's fair enough.
And also those reinforcements do seem to sort of teleport instantaneously, which is slightly problematic from a logistics perspective, but we won't go there.
That's another episode for another podcast.
It is. It really is. The military strategy as shown in Game of Thrones. But back to Austerlitz. So with the centre, the Austrian centre weakened, Napoleon then launches his main assault with Soult's Fourth Corps and shatters the Austrian center, Austrian-Russian center, retakes the Pratzen Heights, manages to also fend off the attack on the right flank. So he shattered the center, on the right flank, he's held and then pushed the Austrians back. You do get some of these guys trying to retreat across frozen ponds. And yes, there are some artillery units who fire over onto the ice to break that ice. Horses fall through, but Napoleon had the legs drained and they found two bodies. Napoleon then spun this in his own propaganda to make it seem like huge numbers of Austrians, literally thousands, drowned. So the version that we are getting in the Ridley Scott film is actually Napoleon's own propaganda narrated back to us. And it is reinforcing that kind of mythology.
Now, I want to mention, because you should absolutely read this book, because of course I'm not often what is in this book that I'm about to mention is about Napoleon and the Guerra and the Alexander I's biography. One of them, I believe she's French, Marie-Pierre Ray, she mentioned that a lot of the Russian soldiers and generals, they blame, because Alexander was there, of course, and we'll get to the peace treaty in a second, but they kind of blame Alexander that he was in the way for the soldiers, that that's one of the reasons they lost Austerlitz, that he was in the way, according to his biographer, that he was shouldn't have been there.
Absolutely right. Kutuzov doesn't want to fight. Kutuzov is the leading Russian general during this period. Very experienced, very skillful commander. And he thinks it's the wrong call. He thinks the better call is to pull back and wait for a better opportunity. And he's overruled by Alexander, who thinks he has a better eye for the situation and thinks that Kutuzov is basically kind of running scared. It's not the case. Kutuzov is just more conscious of the danger that Napoleon poses and is willing to kind of factor that into his considerations. So, yeah. Against the advice of one of his better commanders, Alexander decides to fight Austerlitz and then suffers the consequences. But the Russians do live to fight another day.
That's welcome back managed, to, of course.
Yeah, they managed to pull back at least some elements of their army. But the Austrians, they end up suing for peace. But then we get to Jena and Auerstadt, the War of the Fourth Coalition, the following year, where the Prussians look at the reorganization of Central Europe along French lines, dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire.
I want to add a little footnote to the dissolution, if you will, on the Holy Roman Empire. And this goes back to Joseph II and his late biographer, Derek Bales, the late Professor Bales. He argues that Joseph II wanted to abolish the Holy Roman Empire because he kind of found it a pain in the ass a bit, but it didn't happen, of course. But his dream, as his biographer, as Bales argues, it kind of came true with Napoleon abolishing, because it was kind of a thorn in the side for the Austrians at that point.
I think the thing you have to bear in mind is that the way in which some of these things are done often matters. So the fact that it's done in the wake of a crushing defeat for the Austrians in a dictated peace treaty does basically emasculate the Austrian Empire. It kind of shows, look, the Austrians aren't the dominant force in Europe anymore. France is the dominant force in Europe, and that in turn breeds resentment. But it's also done without any negotiation, excuse me, or meaningful consultation with the Prussians, who are also a rising force and a significant power within Central Europe. And they look at this and go, well, this is not okay. This is a humiliation. So they declare war in 1806 when they are not even remotely ready for it. And then you get
they're not Frederick the Great, let's put it that way.
No, they're really not. And they get absolutely humiliated at Jena and Auerstadt. But it is Davout who is the key there. So he uses a single corps to fend off the vast majority of the Austrian army in his own battle, whilst Napoleon thinks that he's found the entirety of the Prussian army, refuses to send Davout reinforcements, famously remarks to a messenger, your marshal is seeing double. And it's only after the battle that the realization comes to light that Davout has held the line and beaten almost all of the Prussian army with one corps, whilst Napoleon has been faffing around with the remainder of it, targeting a single Prussian corps. So this is Jener und Auerstedt is much more a story of Davout's success than Napoleon's, but we associate it with Napoleon because of the Napoleonic propaganda.
And I want to go back to the famous bridge meeting between Alexander and Napoleon, because at this point we should bring up as well, and you mentioned this a few times, that Josephine was beyond the age of getting children, and he needed to divorce Josephine because he wanted that new dynasty in France that would rule France as his heirs do. And without heirs, that's simply not possible. His brothers would not succeed him, so that's one of the reasons needed. And one of the really themes that come up in the bridge peace treaty, of course, is that his new marriage and deal that I won't know.
That's a little bit later. So that's following the Austrian defeat. So it's the Austrian princess Marie Louise. She's 18 at the time, and
she infamously put both in the order of Corsica.
She's been raised in Austria. Most of her life has seen her nation at war with France. She's been steeped in anti-Napoleonic, pro-Austrian propaganda all of her life, and then she suddenly gets married off to this guy as a pawn in a political game, because Napoleon is looking for not only somebody who can produce an heir for him, but also he's looking for legitimacy, and by combining his dynasty with an established dynasty in the form of the Austrians, he thinks he can acquire that because his offspring are therefore going to be part of that whole other house in Europe.
But again, he is considering a Russian princess, but of course I don't think Alexander seriously considered it. And then again, Talleyrand, he kind of bullies Alexander a little bit for it, and they almost use him, but Talleyrand again comes in, and then again this is according to his biographer in Marie-Pierre Ray, who claims that Talleyrand tells Alexander that he has an Austrian princess in mind, that kind of goes to make Alexander change his mind that no, he's not going to marry one of my princesses, you know.
There are a lot of movements back and forth within this. So the meeting that we're talking about is the Treaty of Tilsit, which takes place on a raft in the middle of the river. Napoleon thinks he plays a blinder, and he thinks that he kind of woos Tsar Alexander. I think Tsar Alexander views the whole thing quite differently and sees Napoleon as somebody that he's got to make peace with, particularly in the wake of Friedland. And so is perhaps a more reluctant is more reluctant in his acceptance of the terms that are agreed there. It does bring peace, but only until the Austrians kick off in 1809. So you're talking, well, and then of course you've got the situation in Portugal and Spain, but part of the issue with it all is that it creates this sense of security for Napoleon, and it's a full sense of security, and it creates this impression within his mind that he can dictate the economic policy of Europe through the continental system. You can understand why, because at this point the only enemy left is Britain, and so you would look to try and deal with that last enemy and have a what you might call a Pax Napoleonica, a Napoleonic peace in Europe, but it doesn't transpire that way.
And I want to add that. So that's, of course, that's the thing we have to talk about, is after the divorce and the marriage with Marie-Louise, because she does, like we said, she told him the order, of course, because she was brought up believing he was this monstrous, and again we come back to the order of Corsica when he is in Sentinel, of course, but again she does seem to eventually warm up with Napoleon, and Josephine, of course, the divorced. What happens with Josephine after the divorce? It does generally seem to send her money still, but what happens with her after the divorce and the marriage with Marie-Louise?
So Josephine is moved, she lives the rest of her life in relative comfort. She is moved to an estate outside of Paris, Napoleon does periodically go and say hi for all intents and purposes. There is this sort of enduring question of, does Napoleon still love Josephine? And in some respects, I think, yes, he probably did in his own way. He actually, when his son is born, he actually takes his son out to for Josephine to see, which is a bit of an odd one, in kind of showing, look, this is what's happened since, and this is
kind
what
of in your face to your ex kind of thing.
It is a bit, but maybe in another sense, he's kind of, I don't know, I don't really understand the motivations behind it. But maybe it's a kind of a pride thing. Look, I've finally achieved this, and you know, be happy for me. I'm not quite sure.
I can't think what Josephine must be thinking. Actually, not father son for you, but here you show me this another broad, who you know, father or son for you. So you know,
I mean, it wasn't his first son, so he'd had illegitimate kids before the breakup of the relationship, and it was that told him that Josephine was the one who couldn't have kids, because before this point he thought that he was the issue and that he was the one who couldn't have the kids. So it's a difficult relationship. It's hard not to feel for Josephine. It's also very hard not to feel for Marie-Louise, kind of thrust into this situation. She is literally sold off. She is part of the price of peace for Austria. And in her own way, yeah, I think she learns to have an affection for Napoleon. It's not the sort of the romance story that we associate with Napoleon and Josephine, but I mean, they have a kid together, and that creates a whole series of very complex emotions in that relationship, which you have to be aware of. But of course, when Napoleon's exiled to Elba and then subsequently returns in 1815, Marie-Louise doesn't go to join him and prevents Napoleon from seeing his son, which is quite a blow.
Before we go there, of course, there is something I want to talk about. As we talked about, the peace treaty with Russia does not last very long. And this is where, and we see this in the trailer as well, and I want to add that this episode was, by the way, recorded before the movie came out. So the movie, if you're watching this after, there is a lot of speculation because we haven't seen the movie yet, of course, because it's not out yet. But I want to talk about, and you see this in the trailer as well, the burning of Moscow. So let's talk about what is perhaps one of the most interesting parts I find in of Napoleon's march on Moscow.
It's the beginning of the end, ultimately. And it shouldn't have been, really. So he assembles one of the biggest armies that Europe has ever seen at this point in time. So about 500,000 men. And he marches it into Russia with the aim of doing what he's done so many times before, secure that overwhelming, crushing victory, then force Tsar Alexander to sit down at the negotiating table again and secure another peace, and therefore reestablish peace in Europe for however long. And once he's done that, then maybe he can go and deal with Spain and Portugal. Doesn't work out that way, because by this point people are learning. They know that Napoleon is a dangerous animal, and so the Russian strategy becomes an attempt to basically inflict huge damage to themselves but not give Napoleon what he wants. So they adopt this scorched earth policy. It's not the first time scorched earth has been used during this conflict. Wellington actually uses it in Portugal during one point, but we don't have time for a deep dive on the Peninsular War. And the idea is that they will keep retreating and retreating and retreating and retreating and not fighting Napoleon if they can avoid it, because they know that face him in the open field and he'll do what he always does, which is crush them. Eventually, they reach a point where they do have to fight Borodino. It's a bloody stalemate of a battle. But in effect, Napoleon wins because the Russians pull back and they enable Napoleon to take Moscow. But the trouble is, he should never have been that deep into Russia anyway, because supplies are a massive issue for the French. From day one, virtually
Unless you remember
of the
that
campaign.
railroads was not invented yet, so it would
Exactly.
be even harder for supplies to arrive.
Everything is being moved either on the back of a person or by horse and cart. And if you've got 500,000 men on the march with their horses, with the baggage, with their battalion wives, with camp followers, and all the rest of it, it is a horde
You
that
don't
you've got
have
to
a
keep
bad
fed.
time.
It's not going to go well. And it didn't. And if you read the accounts, you can see that the French are hemorrhaging men as they go into Russia. They lose more men going into Russia than they do coming out. It's not the winter that
Doesn't he lose
destroys
like
Napoleon's.
half the doesn't he lose like half his army just by entering Russia or
More than,
something?
more than, more people die as a result of the march in. It's not the Russian winter that destroys Napoleon's army. It's actually the Russian summer and the supply issues. It's horrendous. But they occupy Moscow, which the Russians burn down again, scorched earth, huge, what we'd call self-immolation, kind of almost like self-harm, but on a national scale. Napoleon realizes that there aren't the supplies to last out the winter. He keeps trying to persuade Tsar Alexander to come negotiate with him, and the Tsar abjectly refuses, but doesn't tell Napoleon that he refuses. He just doesn't bother responding, which
I want
therefore
to
leaves.
add as well that doesn't they release lunatics from lunatic asylums and
Oh,
into the
they
streets
open the
of
prisons
Moscow?
as well to help with the looting and the general carnage in the place. But because he keeps Napoleon waiting, and because Napoleon's now stuck so far out on a limb and hasn't stopped at Vilna, as was at one point the plan, it means that he's stuck there, no prospect of supplies. If he stays, he dies. Now, when he does make the call, ultimately it's a call that's made way too late. It should have been made a few weeks before. The snows start to fall. And then we've got that classic image that we have of the Russian retreat. He tries actually to not go back the way he came. He tries to go south to the region sort of around what is now Ukraine in order to spend the winter there in a place that is well supplied, and then plan another campaign in the next year. But at the Battle of that's easy for me to say, Maroslavets, the Russians bar the road south and stop Napoleon from being able to head south as he'd planned. And so he has to go back the way he came, which wasn't supplying his men adequately on the way in. It sure as hell isn't going to supply them adequately on the way out. Now, it's worth saying the Russians also suffer horrifically during this because they're experiencing the same weather conditions. They're also going through the same country. So supply is a huge problem. But of the huge 500,000 plus reinforcements, actually taking up to something like 600,000, maybe 650,000, who went into Russia over the course of that campaign, 10% make it out. Napoleon suffers 90% casualties, and it shatters that image of invincibility that he has.
I don't ask, why did he not march on St. Petersburg? Why did he choose Moscow? Wouldn't it make more sense considering St. Petersburg is the capital, at least it's not Moscow that is the capital, that it would be a more blow to go against St. Petersburg? Do we know why he chose not to?
That is a great question. I don't know the answer, and I should. Sorry, I can't answer that one for you.
I mean,
Yeah, you stumped me.
but it would make more sense to me that it should go for St. Petersburg and not Moscow. It's even closer to the, not as far inland, and it's narrow sea. It has, it has a strategic reason, I think, and it's the capital of the Russian Empire as well. So it would make more sense to me to go to St. Petersburg and not Moscow.
I mean, it's Napoleon. He'll have had his reasons. I wonder if the rationale is that is partly kind of dictated by military events. You know, where are the armies that you're trying to strike? Where can you go and where can't you go? Because there's not just one Russian army. There are a series of Russian armies floating around during this period. And Napoleon's kind of trying to wield this huge force, but in a detached way. So you've got some detachments up in the north, some in kind of the center and the south. And so I would imagine that he gets drawn because he's trying to chase the Russians. His aim actually isn't Moscow. His aim is the Russian army. Shatter the Russian army, and then I can get peace. So I'd imagine that's probably what goes into it all.
Another footnote I would like to add, of course, during the peace with after Auschwitz, Tsar Alexander I invades Finland, and again, this is where we get comic Bernadotte comes in, because, as you know, the Swedes, they threw out the other king, and Bernadotte becomes king, which is Napoleon, and Bernadotte doesn't go along quite well. So so he kind of wants to get rid of Bernadotte and says, okay, you can have, because the Swedes wanted a French king, and then Napoleon says, okay, why not take Bernadotte? And they hope in Bernadotte that they can reconquer Finland, but that's after the Napoleonic Wars, because Denmark shows Napoleonic side, because England bombarded their capital.
And why would you join England? In order to steal their fleet.
Yeah, why would you join somebody who just bombarded your capital? It's a strategic reason. And of course, that when it loses the war because of the Kiel Treaty, Norway goes to Sweden. And we made a two-part episode about this as well, where we talk more about Bernadotte's rule. And which I would highly recommend listening to, because it's a really good episode. But anyway, let's go back. Do you have another question to ask you, of course? What did you think about the War and Peace, and if you have read it, and how accurate and does it portray Napoleonic era?
It looks great. So on that sense, I kind of like it. But you've got to bear in mind that it is a story, and so I approach War and Peace much more in terms of how well does it kind of tell... so if you're talking about the costume drama, you know, how well is it true to the book? Tolstoy read widely, but we've always got to be careful that, you know, it's a story, and there's that danger of accepting Tolstoy's account at face value, in the same way that there's that danger of accepting Victor Hugo's account of Waterloo and Les Miserables at face value. And so you get things that are picked up from these books that people think they know about the battle, but in reality are total myths.
Of course, so I'm sorry to say we are running out of time, so we just have to talk about the Battle of Leipzig and, of course, his banishment to Elba as well before we go into the last 100 days and St. Helena. So we have to, I'm sorry for rushing a little bit, and we will come back more in detail on the Napoleonic War in the future, but let's talk about Leipzig, Elba, and St. Helena, of course.
Yeah, so this is the end game, fundamentally. Initially, it's just Russia and Prussia who kind of look at this and go, the clock is ticking, now is the moment to strike. So Prussia's gone through a whole phase of reorganizing its army, but there is huge resentment in Prussia at the humiliation that they experienced in 1806 through the campaign that led to Jena and Auerstedt and the sort of dismemberment of chunks of their nation. So there's this, you can see the sort of the seeds that Napoleon sows that then come back to bite him when he starts to look weak. So in the early parts of the 1813 campaign, Napoleon does remarkably well. He manages to raise a fresh army using French conscripts, because this is a period of conscription within France, but it's inexperienced, and that has an impact. The trouble is that, as I said, the Allies have learnt how to deal with Napoleon, and that's that. They have a big sit down and work out.
People
learn
from their mistakes, shouldn't you?
I know, staggering. But I mean, you've got to. They took a long time to learn their lesson, let's be fair. But what they agree is that their strategy will be, if Napoleon is facing us, we will withdraw. If Napoleon isn't facing us, then we will stand and fight. And so you get this situation of a lot of maneuver where the Allies are looking for fights with Napoleon's subordinates, but not with Napoleon himself, because they don't trust their quality and their skills against the big guy. Now, there is an interlude in 1813. There is a ceasefire, which both sides need, quite frankly, to kind of pause and rearm. And by the end of it, the Austrians have decided to come back into the fray. So now you've got three big continental nations once again at war with Napoleonic France. They effectively corner Napoleon at Leipzig. At this point, they are willing to fight him for one very simple reason. They have overwhelming advantage in numbers. So hundreds of thousands of men fight what is known as the Battle of the Nations. It's the largest battle in Europe until the advent of the First World War. And to massively simplify it, with one eye on the time, Napoleon loses, has to try and pull back over a single bridge. The bridge gets blown too early, so chunks of his army are trapped on the wrong side. People try and swim across the river, but it's cold. It's autumn by this point, and many of them drown. And it, again, kind of shatters Napoleon's control over Central Europe. So now he's lost two major campaigns. 1814 dawns. He raises another army, again, tries to defend France. He is offered peace.
If I may say so, we speak about this in Romanov episode part two as well, where yes, he raises another army, but this is not a Grand Armée that worked into Russia. These are inexperienced soldiers that just basically have less than on experience in combat. So it's, yes, while they may be huge in numbers, they are inexperienced and they are not the same Grand Armée that Napoleon began with. So there's several factors here that we have to think about as well.
There are, and ultimately that takes its toll. Eventually, it's very clear that Napoleon isn't going to win this. Marmont defects because he knows that it's no longer within France's interest to keep fighting. It's just going to tear the country apart. So Napoleon is forced by his own marshals to resign. They turn around and say, look, the game is up. You know, we can't follow you. We can't keep fighting. Napoleon is then exiled to Elba, an island in the Mediterranean, where the idea is that he'll have a very small force of 1,000 men, so his own little mini army, a very small navy, a couple of ships, very small ones. And initially he seems to like it. He sets about kind of trying to reorganize things, education system and all the rest of it.
But again, fun is a problem as well, because he does run out of funds to support what he wants to do for
Elba. He does. I mean, he doesn't get paid, in fairness. He's meant to get a very hefty payment from the King of France, which then doesn't materialize. Then the Allies start falling out, and he sees this, particularly with the good disgruntlement within France itself, at the restored Bourbon monarchy, as an opportunity to come back and reestablish himself. So he attempts that. That leads to the Hundred Days. The other nations in Europe look at this and go, no, we kicked you off the throne once before. We're not just going to sit back and let you reoccupy this throne. Regather your strength and then come after us with all of your vengeance and desire for revenge. So they declare war very specifically on Napoleon himself and not on France. Part of the reason they can't declare war on France is because they don't recognize Napoleon as the rightful ruler of France. As far as they're concerned, there is a rightful ruler of France who's been usurped by Napoleon. That then leads to the Waterloo campaign. You could do an episode just on the Waterloo campaign, quite frankly. And ultimately, Napoleon
The Hundred
loses.
Days as well, of course, is an episode in itself.
It is indeed. Napoleon ultimately loses, is forced to resign, abdicate for a second time, and is exiled to St. Helena, where he dies in 1821, not of poisoning by the British government, despite what people claim, but from stomach cancer.
And there is a bit problematic with this, with his banishment to St. Helena as well. Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have time to go into that, but thank you so much for coming on. Before you go, do you have anything you want to promote on social media where you... Unfortunately, Zach has to go. He has a BBC interview that he has to do because, of course, yeah, well, that's more important, understandably. But
I'm very sorry, folks. I've been ill over the last few days, so I've had to kind of reshuffle everything before I fly out to Spain.
That's quite fine. I'm going to pause the podcast for a bit, and I'm going to finish up for you. And of course, and then you can leave and we have more time to discuss this later. So I'm going to pause the podcast for a little bit and then I'll be right back and to finish the episode. Yeah, so unfortunately, Zach has to leave. So, but I'm going to finish up the episode. I'm going to try my best to finish up the episode. So again, so the problem with St. Helena is that Napoleon wasn't really a prisoner of war. He wasn't. So they didn't know what it was, and again this comes up in the discussion when he dies in 1820s. But again, I want to thank everyone so much for listening to this podcast. I hope you liked it, and if you can find Zach on Twitter and the CW, that's just generally a second. I'm so sorry about this. We had to end rather roughly. I normally don't do this, but let's try. CW White History is Zach's Twitter, so absolutely follow him there. He gives some really good insight into what Napoleon movie and Napoleon, of course, and he shares some really cool stuff there. He is on the Napoleon channel on YouTube as well, so make sure to check him out there. He's the Napoleonic War podcast. Is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, so you can listen to Zach there as well. I would highly recommend that you go follow him there. Now, we are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. I'm sorry, I feel a little bit awkward doing this alone because I normally do this and this way, as I said. But if you're on Spotify, please give us 5 stars. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, consider writing a review. That would help us out a lot. But if you are on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. We will, of course, go into more detail on Napoleon in a future episode, but this was hopefully quite a good overview of Napoleon himself. So hopefully, if you go into the movie, you'll have a better understanding of the man and the myth himself. Thank you for listening. My name is Alan, and I'll see you next time.